Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from The Bugle.
Hello and welcome to Catharsis. I'm Tiff Stevenson, full-time comedian, part-time, massively unqualified therapist for this podcast only. Each week I talk to a guest about small things that irritate them, pet peeves, gripes, also old wounds that need healing. We're going to get into some old grudges. We'll dive into a topical gripe and a historical beef to see if we can provide some insight or some catharsis at the very least. You can sweat the small stuff with me. Now, briefly, before I introduce my guest, I always like to get into an annoyance of my own. And I've noticed recently a lot of celebrities are turning 50. Let me clarify that. A lot of female celebrities are turning 50 and posting nude selfies. Gwyneth Paltrow did one for her 50th. And I think Jennifer Lopez did one on a bikini in a yacht. Jennifer Aniston just did one. And I'm wondering what's going on, because you know, the conversation around it is, it's not needy, because it's not objectification, because they're old now. So it's no longer it's empowering. It's empowering, Tiffany. Two words you don't want to hear when you've just taken your clothes off. It's empowering. Is it empowering? Or is it exhausting? That's what I want to know. Have I still got to be doing this shit when I'm 60? Have I got to be sexy at 60? Have I got to be on the gram trying to push my tits together, purse trapping, with a copy of Reader's Digest hiding my areola? Is this where we're going to be? Probably a copy of Bella magazine, actually. Better coverage. It is a bigger magazine. But I'm tired. I'm in my 40s and I'm tired already. How long must this continue for? I will ask the opinion of my guest this week, because we are joined by comedian, cricket statistician. I can't even say that properly. Cricket statistician. Is that the correct way of saying it? Podcaster and all-round good guy Andy Zaltzman, welcome.
Hello, Tiff. Hi. I'm already contemplating cancelling my nude 50th birthday shoot, which I've scheduled for October of next year.
Listen, I think if men do it, maybe we can class it as empowering at this point, because it's not the norm. I just want to know: will it be empowering? Will it be brave, Andy?
Well, I don't know. I can't remember the last time I did anything brave or empowering, to be honest. But let's call it that. As long as you call it empowering, it becomes empowering. I might just eat a potato on my 50th instead of posing nude and call that empowering. You know, yeah, taking back control of myself.
As long as it's photographed and put up on the gram for posterity, you can claim anything is either empowering, self-care, or, you know.
Right. Yeah, see, I've not done a lot on Instagram. I set it up, I think, for your shows during lockdown, and I've never used it. So maybe that's why I'm not more powerful. I've not empowered myself using the modern tools.
What's this account? It just stands pictures of cricketers and occasionally shares bits of information from podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what the world needs, I think.
Welcome to the podcast. We begin every week, as you may well know, by diving into an old grudge. So something from your past that you wish you'd handled differently, or something that you just can't quite let go of. Hit me, Andy. What have you brought to the table?
Well, I've thought about this a lot, and I think through my life I've tried to sort of remove grudges, because as a child I was really over competitive in a way that, you know, just playing a sports match, I'd get in this sort of such a state of emotional sort of tension and overwroughtness that I ended up not enjoying it at all, even if my team won. And I think gradually through my teenage years I learned the spiritual power of not giving a shit and about stuff like that. And I think that, you know, that sort of helped me through life. So, I mean, in terms of personal grudges from childhood, I don't have many from childhood. I mean, I've got a few from my comedy career, but more with specific audiences. For example, the Manchester Comedy Store, December 2002. I had a grudge with, I think, pretty much all 400 people who were at that gig. And I'm sure.
Oh, this feeling is a 20-year-old grudge, Andy.
Yeah, this is a feeling that's entirely mutual. And the Comedy Store has never booked me since. So presumably, I mean, they're in on the grudge as well. So, I try to avoid grudges, because I think partly because I didn't deal with them very well as a youngster, and I found, you know, in comedy, I guess in any form of sort of competitive showbiz, there's grudges can sort of eat you up a bit, and so I learned the powers of my sort of ancient stoicism of not allowing these things to take you over. But I don't know. I'm I guess if I had a showbiz grudge, and again, it's not something that sort of eats away at my soul. It would probably be with the former TV show Mock the Week, which you yourself graced on numerous occasions, who never booked me in, I don't know how many years it lasted, 16, 17 years. And initially it annoyed me for the first sort of 4 or 5 years. I used to think, oh, I'll be quite, you know, they ought to be booking me. And then it reached the point where I didn't want to be asked to do it, because I really wanted to say no, but I didn't think I'd have the mental strength or humility to do that. And, you know, the vanity of showbiz would want me to get on the telly. But luckily, they took that decision out of my hands by never asking me in the entire history of the show, which has now ended. So I guess that would be my showbiz grudge. But to be honest, there's plenty of TV shows that have never booked me. So I don't know why I've picked on that one specifically, but
I might have an idea. Well, yeah. Firstly, their loss, because you would be astonishing on that show, as anyone who's listened to The Bugle knows. Like, there's no one out there that's better at doing topical and making it discursive, making it silly, making it accessible. So that's on them. But it is, I think the reason that you might feel like that is because John did the show a bunch, right?
John Oliver did the show before he went. I think the time is fled the country to go to America. And at that point, we were working really closely together on radio and in live stuff. So I felt that I probably could have done a job on it, but then in the end, it almost became a matter of pride that I'd never been asked, and I then started to look upon it as a badge of honour that they'd never asked me to do it. So,
Well, it is finished now. However, I just found out the other day via sources, I don't know why I'm putting that in quotation marks, someone sent me a text, that they're creating an American version of it.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I look forward to not being asked to do that as well. So,
that was, I wonder, maybe John will do that one again. But I guess, I believe Trevor Noah, yes. I don't know if he's hosting it. But I saw it announced the other day. But here's the thing. It's not like there's other places you can get your topical fix if you enjoy topical comedy. But yes, it's such an odd, I mean, I'd quite like to unpack just like show business and your disappointments in general, because there's stuff that I haven't done. And then what you find yourself doing, which is so insane, is sitting there going, well, I'm as funny as that person. I've also done this. I've got this many Instagram followers. I've got this many. What is my agent doing? And it's it leads nowhere good ever, yes. Right?
Yeah, it leads to a spiral of bitterness. And I'm telling you, when I had points in my career, particularly after John had gone to America, and we'd been doing quite a bit of stuff on BBC Radio, and we had two series cancelled simultaneously, and John got the Daily Show job, and so I had to do what was supposed to be our two-handed Edinburgh show solo at fairly short notice, and my wife and I found out that she was pregnant all within the space of about 3 or 4 weeks in the summer of 2006, which was a time of, I guess, upheaval in my career, that various things that I've been working on sort of ended suddenly. I had an exciting new development on a personal level. And I did, for a while, really until The Bugle started, which was a year and a bit later when John and I started the podcast, I did find myself getting a bit sort of bitter about the fact that I'd sort of hit a sort of career buffers and couldn't really see how I would advance in that. And John had got this gig on the world's leading comedy show. And it sort of felt like, from working very closely together as sort of equals, things had gone in fairly polarly different directions. Is that a word? Different directions.
Yeah, so I like it, is now.
I guess, you just have to... I think fundamentally that, there's... If you accept that there's a certain element in comedy, as in any job, where there's an element of meritocracy and there's an element of luck, and the two often sort of play off each other. And I think I was lucky enough that I could, throughout this, I was still sort of managing to make a living from it. And once the Bugle started, it was nice for me to be working with John again, but also that sort of gave me a new audience for stand-up that I hadn't really got from radio, which never really translated into sort of live ticket sales. But the Bugle sort of almost restarted my stand-up career. And then sort of latterly, doing more, the work I do in cricket as a cricket statistician, that again was some, another plank that, I gradually learned to, be satisfied with my career and realised that, if things weren't happening for me, it was largely my own fault rather than anything to do with... bad fortune. So again, it's, I guess, taking it's quite a stoic idea from the ancient stoic philosophies of understanding the things that you have control of and the things that you don't.
Is that Marcus Aurelius?
Yeah, he was a classic stoic, one of the all-time greats.
He said, "If you don't get mocked the weak, chill." As he famously said, "If you don't get mocked the weak, chill." And I think that's a really nice way to think of it. Also that you carved your own thing. And I think a lot of the time in this business, we think so much about gatekeepers and people who are going to hand us this career. And so much of that has changed for the better, in that you don't need an executive producer somewhere or someone at a channel to say, yes, we give you an opportunity. Because a lot of the time when you're doing TV, you're trying to do it to sell tickets to your live tours and shows. You're also doing it because it's TV and it's great and it's wow. But, certain panel shows, like the one we mentioned, it's not as if they're quite a lot of prep and they don't pay a huge amount of money. And they're fun to do. But one of the main reasons is, well, if I do this, I will sell X amount of tickets to my Edinburgh show or whatever else. So now there's just this way... And actually, you're at the forefront of doing that. You are one of the innovators in this space, you and John, with creating a podcast before anyone else really had here, a comedy podcast where two comedians discuss events. And now, because of you guys, thank you. Now everyone has a podcast.
Yes, I mean, I think that might be giving us slightly too much credit, as if we sort of had this grand idea to strike out, whereas what actually happened was we were offered a deal to do a podcast, and we basically said, well, what's a podcast? And this was 2007 when it was all fairly new. My sister, Helen, she already started her podcast even earlier. And I mean, she's a very good example, I think, what you were saying about how the internet... enabled people to carve their own niche. She's made a very successful podcasting career. Her main thing now is essentially an etymology podcast, and makes a very good living from it in a way that would not have been possible. If you wanted to do an etymology show pre-podcasting, you might have got, you know, one 15-minute or half-hour slot on the radio if you were lucky, and then it would have just gone out and then disappeared, and that would have been that. Whereas, you know, when we started The Bugle, as I said, within a few weeks, when we only had a few thousand listeners, we were lucky when we started. We had a bit of, we were hosted by The Times, and they sort of paid us so we could devote the time to treat it like a radio show, essentially, and gave us a producer, so we didn't have to, you know, worry about the technical side of it. So we were very fortunate in that regard. But it was very clear to me early on that it enabled, as a format, it gave, enabled you to build your own audience, and, you know, as long as you could sustain that, it became viable in a way that, you know, do a radio show and it could be, you know, the best radio show you could possibly make, and it would go out at 11 p.m. On a Thursday night. 20,000 people would hear it whilst falling asleep, and no one would ever hear it again. You think, well, what exactly was the point of that? So did some really great radio that just sort of disappeared. And that I guess is a grudge. I did a show with John and Chris Addison called The Department that I'm still really proud of, and still makes me laugh whenever it comes up on my shuffle on my music player, and it just sort of disappeared, and I felt that, you know, that should have had a greater life than it did. But yeah, the internet sort of enabled you to carve that niche, and I guess that sort of then takes away the avenues for bitterness of having to be dependent on other people, because it gave comedians and people in all other, you know, sort of creative spheres, in a way, a lot more agency over their own work and their own you know, fan base, listener base.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The agency is the bit that then helps you, because you feel like you've got moves. You can't just blame it on not getting opportunities with certain people. You can begin to create. And now we're creeping into AI, so that's a discussion for another time, where they will remove the need for comedians and writers altogether, because a computer will be coming up with it all. Well, thank you for sharing your old grudge. Maybe, you know, who knows what will happen in the future. America, hello.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This section of the podcast we call Topical Cream. That's where we attempt to apply some balm to a stingy news story that's got you all het up. So what's wound you up? What's got you?
Well, can I just choose all news? Is that too broad?
No, that's good. That's a good answer.
Because with the Bugle and doing the news quiz on Radio 4, another topical show, I spend so much of my time immersed in news, reading news, and I make the extreme mistake of reading below the lines comments on news articles.
Which
is a path to full-scale misanthropy and pessimism about the human condition. But it's just that the tone of news now is so, I don't know, confrontational, heightened. I mean, obviously there's a lot of shit going on in the world, as there always has been, I guess, probably since humans started evolving, frankly. But I find, yeah, the tone of news, that needs your soothing balm, Tiff. It's it just, everything seems so furious all the time. And I think part of that is because, as a species, I believe we have lost the art of disagreement. and the ability to hold different opinions and think that someone is completely wrong about something, and not to respect their views, but to sort of accept the fact that there are different ways of looking at things and just sort of get on with it. I find that the tone of all news, that's what I want to have a balm applied to.
Combative. It feels always combative. And I think what you're talking about there, Andy, is something that I remember it from the old times. It's called nuance.
Yeah, nuance. It's basically banned, I think, now. I mean, I guess there's two ways of looking at nuance. Either you think it's great or you think it's fucking shit, and there's nothing in between.
Nuance has been banned. It's been it's on the illegal thoughts list. Yes, that you could hold competing thoughts. And I think that's, as a progressive society, we want to be able to discuss in a insanely combative way why someone might think differently. And that's kind of one of the things I love about stand-up, I guess, is that you can put across your viewpoint or your worldview across an hour when you're doing a show, or an hour and a half on a tour show, and be detailed and nuanced about it and show how you arrive there and stuff. But I feel like there's so many voices now. I mean, you're saying you read the comments. I used to have a rule that I would treat them like the Portaloo at Glastonbury. In that you don't look down, you don't look at that bit, because it's just turd upon turd upon turd upon turd. However, if you are writing a topical show, sometimes you are going in there looking for what lunatic opinions are there so I can debunk them, or so I can do the logic against them. So sometimes it is useful to know what people are saying, but I feel like there's too many voices. I feel like the internet, when we say it's a good thing and it's democratized a lot of stuff, it also means that everyone's screaming and every voice is competing at an equal level. It used to be dependent on followers, but not anymore. Because I find now, if you just tweet something insane on Twitter, like really contrarian or like just awful, it will get the engagement, because that kind of black and white thinking is what lands there. And so you're left going, can I even use this platform anymore, yes, in a way that's useful?
And you talked about feeling sort of exhausted by it. And I do often feel just exhausted by the process of consuming news. And just the level of human energy expended in sort of hating things and and hating other people's opinions on things. It's where I'm getting too old for that. Like I said, I'm nearly 50. I've got to think about my naked photo shoot, Tiff. I don't have time for delving through the furies of modern life.
I get to a point where I second guess myself, because I used to do, I guess, what I thought were like quite nuanced threads on things on Twitter, and now I just hardly do any. I'll do the occasional joke, but even then, it's at the point on Twitter where you'll tweet something like very obviously a joke, like, oh, I think I've nearly farted myself to death today. And then someone will come and go, my cousin died from farting himself to death. Why do you think this is funny? You know, like, and you're like, okay, I don't even know the point of me being here anymore when I can't even do that. But it's tiring. Here's the thing. A few years back in a show, I talked about the American consumption of news versus our consumption. And I think that Americans are more used to dealing with this rolling 24-hour news coverage, relentless. And I think it was talked about in Bowling for Columbine. You know, he talked about the fact that Americans are fed a diet of fear a lot of the time. But I feel like we have this same diet now. We have 24-hour news channels on the TV and websites that are constantly updating, as well as now added on top of those social media, which are essentially news feeds as well. And in America, at least there's a climate of people go to therapy, is what I'm trying to say. There's an acceptance of therapy in America that there sort of isn't here, in a way. So Americans have all of that fear and rage online, but they also have potentially more outlets to go and get help if they can afford to. Whereas here, I describe us as a nation of bottlers, not in a fight sense, but we just don't talk about our feelings, or so they can all come out at Christmas dinner. You know, like, I remember Andy Murray getting therapy before Wimbledon and all of the newspapers reporting it like, Andy Murray visits shrink. Andy Murray sees head quack. You can guess which paper that was. Yeah. And it was as if to say, who do you think you are going sorting your problems out of a professional? You save that shit for Christmas dinner like everyone else. You ruin turkey with your grudges. And so I feel like we are not, as Brits, as equipped to deal with this relentless news coverage as perhaps the Americans are. I mean, probably no human is, but I feel in particular British people, in that weird way of like not wanting to discuss our feelings or not wanting to appear vulnerable, stiff upper lip and all that. I feel like we can't cope.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And also, just in terms of how news is presented, there's a prominent broadsheet newspaper in this country that I grew up with living in Tunbridge Wells. It seems that almost everything in it has now become an issue of such extremity, of everything being, you know, catastrophic or, you know, massively destructive. Everything is, oh, Europe is doomed, Britain is doomed, everything's doomed. And again, this comes back to that issue of nuance and balance. And that, it seems that those are things that may be consigned to the Museum of History.
What do we do? How do we fix the news, Andy? I feel like it's my job as a completely unqualified therapist on this podcast to provide solutions, and I don't know what the solutions are.
I don't know if there just needs to be, I don't know, like a pop. And this is one of the things that irritates me most about the universe at the moment is you know, just the amount of pop-ups that come up when you're on the internet, and it makes me sort of hanker for the early days of the internet when you could just read something without something else flying into your face. But maybe we need to harness this, and you know, every article, whenever you read it or if you read a comment, there should be a pop-up of a you know, a benevolent old person's face saying, "Of course, this could all be bullshit," this is just one way of looking at it, and just everyone just calm, just calm, just, you know, these faces just calming you down, maybe with a bit of soothing music.
I think the paperclip should come up, definitely. Yep. When you see it, like, there should be a paperclip for you appear to be engaging in whataboutery, can I help? Yeah, so if we could just get all of the different rhetorical devices or kind of get-outs that people seem to use in online debate and, soothe. Soothe with maybe a video of some. I'm trying to think of who has the most soothing. Maybe Joanna Lumley.
Just popping Attenborough up. I mean, we need to absolutely dredge everything from Attenborough before he moves to the higher realm, if we may put it euphemistically, because he's 96 now. You probably think he's nearer the end of his career than the start, even though he's obviously, throughout his career in wildlife documentaries, he's been extracting serums from every species he's ever met to try and create some kind of elixir of immortality. So, I mean, it's quite possible that he will never die. But just in case he does, I think we need to... Basically, he should just be in a recording studio 24 hours a day.
Yes.
6 days a week. We'll give him Wednesdays off. Just recording benevolent things to try and soothe the human race through the next couple of thousand years.
It's time for Unpopular Opinion. This is where I ask my guest to bring something to the table that they love, everyone else hates, or vice versa.
I found it quite hard, actually, to find something that's... I mean, it's quite hard to know what everyone hates and or everyone loves. I do have a massive, deep-seated philosophical hatred of Great British Bake Off as a TV show and everything it stands for.
Come on, that's an unpopular opinion. Come on.
Partly because I don't mind the occasional cookery show. I quite enjoy MasterChef, but I fundamentally I'm not interested in cakes. So that's at one point. But it's
what
I don't know,
cake
I
find, hurt you, Andy?
I don't know, Tiff. This probably goes. I'm not sure we can go into enough depth in the time we've got available. It's the sort of relentless positivity of reality shows like that. Not just Bake Off, but you know others in the same stable. The formulaic nature of these shows drives me mad. It gets to the point where, and you know, I don't actively watch them, but other people in my close family enjoy them. Although I've managed to keep the family together despite that, so I have been in the room, and it's you know, that pause before they announce the winner or loser, and the way it's set up in all these shows, there's something that drives me up the fucking wall with that. I don't know if it's just because it's so. I guess it's the repetitive, formulaic nature of it. Oh, come on! How many years have we been doing this now? There must be a better way of doing it. But maybe
I'm going to ask for that pause at the cricket now.
Yeah, okay, please do.
I'm going to ask for that. I'm going to ask for the host of Bake Off to come in. I don't know who it is now at the moment. Is it Prue Leith?
I can't remember. I think
one of the judges now.
I think they might have.
Oh, Noel Fielding and... Yeah. It's turning over. Yes. Like an apple yes. Turnover.
Well, I mean, also it's now. I mean, it does appear that stand up comedy, which you know, when we started doing it, Tiff, I always felt like something that people wanted to do for the love of comedy or as an art form in itself. And now it's turned out it's just a stepping stone to hosting a fucking reality show for it seems 98% of all comedians.
I knew we'd get at it. I knew if we just scratched the surface.
Well, so that's something that irritates me on a regular basis.
Is it the Britishness of the Great British Bake Off? Is it? Do you find it twee? Do you?
I do a bit, yeah. But I mean, it's really a universal thing. I think I could watch a sort of show of that ilk in any language on any topic, and it would irritate me just as much. Regardless of where
they're going to reveal the winner, but first we're going to go to ad break. We're going to an ad break before orthopedic mattresses before you find out who's won this week's. So you feel the same way about MasterChef or any kind of?
I quite like cooking. So at least with MasterChef, I might learn something. And I most enjoy the professional version. So you're seeing. You're seeing pros doing pro stuff, but even then, it's so formulaic, which I guess is you know why it works. People like formula. I love sport, and I guess sport works to a formula. But for whatever reason, that gets my quite easily irritable goat.
Well, also there's been much discussion about this because we're in the midst of a strike in America of the Writers Guild. But the last time there was a big strike, the discussion has been that that's when reality TV really flourished because all of a sudden they were like, well, we can't get any writers. So let's just get people on TV acting like arseholes.
Yes.
I'm not saying that's what happens on Bake Off, but just on various other shows. So we could be in for another flood of more reality.
Yes.
Extra reality. We'll make it even more real by just having everyone film it on their phones.
Yes. I mean, the possibilities are, I think, you know, that Pandora's box of has been opened and the creative wasteland will take over the world. But in terms of other things that I dislike, but other people do, nightclubs, I've always found a source of complete bafflement. Game of Thrones irritates me purely because... I feel I ought to love it, but as soon as the first dragon came out, I gave up. Anything to do with fashion. Me and fashion went our separate ways in an atmosphere of mutual hostility many, many decades ago. But sometimes, you know, I think as a comedian and a cricket statistician, I think, you know, what am I doing with my life? What I mean, is there a more pointless way of living? And then I read or I see a fashion supplement. I think, no. I'm still quite a long way to go before reaching that level of pointlessness.
I think this is just my personal opinion. I think there should be a fashion range for people who don't give a shit about fashion.
Yep.
That's what I want to see.
I'm happy to model that. Yep.
Yeah. I want to see stuff like t-shirts that say things like "This will have egg on it later."
Yeah.
Because inevitably, everything you wear will get egg on it at some point, unless you're vegan. Or like, just don't do it, track pants. I can't be arsed, track pants. Fashion for people who don't like fashion. Like, I could get you, if you just had a pair of chinos that just said functional down the side.
Yeah. You know. That would work, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So let's launch it.
On a more sort of positive angle, things that I love that not necessarily people hate, but that people generally don't give much of a shit about. I've got really into squash as a spectator sport. And I feel it's one of the most maligned spectator sports in the world. It's not in the Olympics. It's barely on television. And I went to see a session at the British Open in Birmingham a few weeks ago. And we've watched quite a bit. My wife used to play it, quite a good stand, and my son plays. And it is so fantastically skillful and athletic and dramatic. And you feel, this. Why is the world ignoring this sport? Why is the Olympic movement ignoring this this sport? So that's I'm not sure it's an unpopular opinion, but it's something that baffles me for not being more popular than
I'm with you. So I would like to campaign for this because I play squash. I love squash. It's high octane. It's high octane sport, Andy.
Yes.
Although we hadn't played. Oh, okay. I'll share this with you. We hadn't played for like probably since before the pandemic. And Paul and I used to play quite a lot. And then I was not very good when I started. And then I sort of got better and sort of matched him. And then we were a bit more evenly matched. But we hadn't been for a couple of years. So we booked in and we'd been playing for 15 minutes before Paul stretched too fast for a ball. I just went, I heard something ping in my knee. Right. And then he was just a middle-aged man rolling around on the floor.
That's what grabbing. That's what sport is all about. It's confronting mortality, Tiff. That's a huge part of it.
We had to go to A&E because he was like, you know, we didn't know if he'd done his cruciate or whatever it is. But or it just turned out that I think he'd like sprained or torn something. And in fact, it's been long enough now that the other day I said to him, should we go again? Should we risk it? But it's very much like, am I going to have to wear a gout bracelet going into the squash court? But I love squash, and I do. I would happily watch other people play squash. I like playing squash. I think we should, let's get a squash podcast happening, Andy.
Yeah.
Let's bring it to the masses.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, they should, I think football's just got too big. It's a sport where, you know, it's one of the lowest scoring sports in the world. It's a sport where playing negatively is generally rewarded strategically. Time wasting is strategically advantageous. And it feels like, yeah, the world needs a year off football to let other sports have a go. So all football should be cancelled for a year from, let's let this season finish. Yeah, we start chucking money at other sports and see what happens.
Let's let the sponsorship deals roll in.
Yes.
Gout bracelets for players, sweatbands, sweat headbands. Oh, those goggles.
Yeah.
Are they wearing those in professional games?
Not in professional games. My kid wears them when he plays. But it's having seen it live and quite a bit on TV, I don't think there's any other sport that has less time wasting than squash. It's just relentless. Whereas, you know, tennis, there's quite a lot of piddling around between points, wiping your face with a towel, and squash, it's just non-stop, and yeah, it's brilliant.
Yes, well, I feel like I have a heart attack every time
yes.
I play it. Thank you for sharing your unpopular opinions. It is time to get into a historical beef. This is where we look at something from the past between two rivals, we pick it apart. And I had a couple of suggestions for this week.
Yeah.
But Andy, you came to me and said, no, I want to talk about this.
Yeah. Well, this is, I think, one of the defining rivalries really in the history of this planet. And that is the human race versus itself, which, you know, is a rivalry that goes back a long time now. And when you think of the history of humanity, the amount of time and effort devoted to mutual destruction, the infliction of pain and suffering, and the retardation of human progress under various guises, whether it's religious or political or commercial. But obviously, you know, humans have done a lot of good things. But the amount of damage that we inflict on ourselves as a species, the way that we kind of put brakes on our advancement, despite the genius of the human race, the just unbelievable efforts throughout to slow that down and to destroy ourselves. I think that's one of the great beefs, the great historical rivalries, really. And you see it, you know, on a you know, obviously that's quite macro. Let's get it. I mean, like America, you know, America's it defines itself by its rivalries with, say, Soviet Russia, or now with China now moving forward. But America's greatest rival, obviously, is itself, and it's had obviously moments when that's flared up more, as the 1860s would testify. But America sort of almost symbolises humanity's sort of failures in this regard, of working against its own self-interest in so many ways, politically, in terms of the way its media conducts itself, its business, its racial and social inequalities, and the various justifications. You see that with the gun debate. If you get it, you know, the desire to act against our own self-interest, I think, is one of the things that sets us apart from all the other species on this planet.
That's a very, very good historical beef. I would say it starts, you were talking about the macro. If we want to go to the micro, I often think about this as a performer doing Edinburgh's, and a critic comes to see the show. And then I remember that it's laughable to me that any critic thinks they can be meaner than the voice in my own head.
Yeah.
So how much disgusting self-talk I have here. So the first war, before we even get into wars with everyone else, is with ourselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, maybe that's... Well, we've just expanded that to encompass the whole world.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, that's... I can chuck this showbiz beef. The first review I ever had as a comedian in Edinburgh in 2000, I was doing a show called The Comedy Zone, which was a sort of package show with four comedians. And we got reviewed in the first night, and the Observer, national Sunday newspaper, described me as grindingly mediocre. And fortunately, the journalist, whose name I won't share with you now, but he did not. I don't think he writes. I don't know if he's still a journalist or not. Misspelt my surname, so if you search me on the internet, it doesn't come up.
Ah, oh, amazing. Amazing.
And the next year, a different reviewer in the same paper described me as a genius in the making. And then the following year, another reviewer said I was kind of all right. So I think it probably averaged out over those three reviews as about right.
Well, I think my first year I got every star.
Well, that's the dream in Edinburgh, isn't it? The full house. I don't think I've ever quite managed the full house.
The full house.
Yeah.
There was a one-star review of someone who was very unhappy with my jokes about reproductive rights. And then I found out that she was a born-again Christian. But, yeah, and then I got nice ones and I got, you know. But, yeah, I think the war begins with us. And then as that seeps out, depending on how much we hate ourselves, then that could be how much we can go out and get into it with other people.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing those with me, Andy. Before we sign off for the week, is there anything you'd like to plug that you've got coming up?
Well, the Bugle runs on for all eternity, as it has done since the start of eternity, or 2007. so that's you can hear every week, wherever you are in the universe, as long as you have access to the internet.
Even on Elon Musk's terraformed Mars.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure it'll be there. And yeah, I think if you listen to all the episodes we've ever done back to back, it will now take you longer than the average human lifespan. So so there's a lot of that. I'm doing the news because I'm Radio 4 at the moment. You can get it via BBC Sounds. And I'd also just like to plug cricket in general as a sport.
Thank you for coming on Catharsis.
Pleasure.
Andy, I am on tour all of May, so if you get a chance, you want to come and see me, head to tiffstevenson.co.uk. The dates are listed. They're listed on there. The website hasn't been updated since Brexit, so don't hold out hope for much else. But you can find me there or on Twitter and Instagram and the usual places. Thanks for listening.
You can listen to other programmes from The Bugle, including The Bugle, Catharsis, Tiny Revolutions, Top Stories and The Gargle, wherever you find your podcasts.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.